Choke Points, brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. With the start of July, that means the start of summer in Washington. It also means the annual fee increase approved by the legislature and increasing some tolls to go along with that. So, Chris, tell us what's going up.
Well, the legislature used a lot of fee increases to help pay for the $17 billion transportation package that they passed last session. Some of those fees go up on Friday. Christine Anthony at the Department of Licensing says most of the fee increases center on new license plates.
They're not fee increases to your vehicle registration fees. They're attached to, like, when you're buying a car or if you need to get a replacement license plate or things like that.
So, I'm going to throw some numbers at you, so I'll try to go slow. So the fees that are going up Friday, new license plate, $10. It's now going to be $50. A replacement license plate, $10. Now it's going to be $30. Temporary plate you get from the dealer, used to be $15. It's going to be $40. And a car previously registered in another state, that's normally a $15 charge. That's going to be $50.
They'll really only affect you if you're buying a car or if you order a special design license plate.
Fee increases also hit the new and replacement plates for motorcycles, $4 to $20 for a new one, $4 to $12 for a replacement. And Anthony says now would be the time to get that Hawks or Sounders plate to save some money.
You know, if you were thinking about getting a special design license plate, you might want to do that in the next week.
Yeah, so that's, again, do that by Thursday or else you are going to end up paying more. Now, if you drive the 99 tunnel through Seattle, the toll is going up on Friday as well. Toll going up 3% across the board. That equals 5 to 10 cents a trip, depending on the time of day that you use the tunnel. Toll increase was approved by the Washington State Transportation Commission earlier this year to make up for a drop, or I should say last year, to make up for a drop in the toll revenue during the pandemic. And since I had the DOL on the horn, I decided to ask Anthony how the agency is doing. I hadn't talked to her since kind of the middle of the pandemic when they were having such trouble trying to handle people who needed to get things done, but the offices were closed. And so Anthony says the closures actually helped the agency get a little bit better because it created a new appointment system that they are continuing to use, which is working, and it has increased the services that you can use online.
And if you don't have to come to an office and you can do your transaction online, that's just another service avenue for you.
Now, Anthony still recommends you to make an appointment to make sure that your wait times won't be awful. Of course, the DOL still takes walk-ins. And one more thing from Anthony, you might have heard this before, but the new enhanced driver's license or passport to fly domestically goes into effect next year. Remember the Real ID Act?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Real ID Act that's been passed and postponed and postponed and postponed and postponed? New date, May 3rd. Next year, 10 months. Anthony says you shouldn't wait on that either.
If you're thinking about getting an enhanced license, I would do it sooner rather than later. Again, with the enhanced, we do encourage an appointment just because it takes a little longer.
You might remember President Bush signed the Real ID Act in 2005. The requirement's been pushed more than a deadline. The deadline's been pushed by more than a decade now as states continue to try to grapple with this. So we'll see if May 3rd sticks around.
But
as,
this is real.
Yeah.
This is real.
Yeah, this is the deal where, you know, coming out of 9/11, we have to provide a little bit more information to get that enhanced ID.
And remind us what additional information you have to provide.
I think you just have to provide, more just...
Birth certificate?
Birth certificate, things like that.
Fingerprints?
No, I don't believe so.
DNA? No.
DNA swab? No. One of your eyelashes? No. But it's just a little bit more information. Of course, a passport will always work as well. But that Real ID Act goes into effect at least right now, May 3rd. So it's time to start thinking about
better
that.
Better to do it now than
exactly
wait until May, because we know that there was a backlog for passports for a while.
Exactly. And they're still kind of working their way out of that, too. Mm-hmm. I'm getting mine renewed. So, it's taking a
I just use my
longer.
Little passport card. You can buy a little passport card.
Yeah, you can get those, too. Yeah.
Thing, and that
works to
TSA
exactly.
Loves that.
So. Yeah, so those will always work. But again, this is to fly domestically. This isn't isn't anything crazy. This is like to catch that flight to LA. So you'll need that.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We now have the results of the big Mariners brawl. Let's go to Mike Salk from Seattle Sports 710. So who gets punished?
Well, it's a funky answer to that. The Angels manager got the most number of games, Phil Nevin. And I'll tell you a funny story about him in a moment. But the Mariners actually bore the brunt of having more important people suspended for a long portion of time.
That doesn't seem fair. They were the ones who were... Winker was the one who was hit.
It's very unfair. I would agree with that. It's not just that Winker was hit. It's that the Angels put the Mariners essentially in an impossible position. Rather than using their regular starting pitcher, they brought in a sparsely used reliever and said, all right, you go ahead. You're going to start the game by plunking some guys. They don't care about losing him because he doesn't have much value to their club. He's hitting guys on their team that do have value to the Mariners, who now what? Are supposed to either not respond entirely and take it lying down, or respond and risk being the ones who are losing their more important players. It's really handled poorly.
This idea of a sacrificial pitcher who's put in there specifically to hit somebody, is that like a traditional thing?
I've never seen it before, and I spent quite a bit of the day yesterday texting with some folks I know who played the game and are now retired, played it at the major league level. One thing they all agreed with is that was Bush League, as was taking a second shot. Like, they had their shot to hit Julio Rodriguez. They missed him. You don't get a second shot to then hit Jesse Winker.
He was so bad that he had to try again to hit somebody.
Yeah, although I will say, there was somebody who told me, one of the problems is guys aren't good at hitting people anymore. that it used to be something they were better at. There was also not a lot of surprise that Phil Nevin was involved. Now, he's the manager of the Angels, and he was a player for a long time, played for the Padres and the Twins and the Tigers and the Angels. And I was told this story yesterday by Jared Washburn, who used to play for the Mariners. But in the day Jared Washburn made his debut in the big leagues, Phil Nevin was his catcher for the Angels. They were playing the Royals. And he says, Phil Nevin started two brawls that day.
Oh.
So the story goes that the year before, when Nevin was with the Tigers, he was playing the Royals, and he did something that made them mad. So the Royals had decided they have a long memory, and they're going to drill Phil Nevin the next year in this game that Jared Washburn is making his major league debut as a pitcher in. So they hit Phil Nevin early in the game. The starter hits him. Okay, should be over. They kind of move forward. Well, unfortunately, the first guy out of the pen, the first reliever, was out having a cigarette when Nevin got hit the first time.
Oh my God.
So he didn't realize Nevin had been hit. So he plunked him again right in the back. Now Nevin charges the mound. Huge melee ensues. Guys are fighting.
I can tell Dave is thinking the same thing I'm thinking. How childish is this?
Oh, I thought he was thinking, I can't believe a major league player was smoking a cigarette during a game in 1998. But yes, he might have been thinking that also. Anyway, a second melee occurred later.
I like a good fight, but at the same time, like, baseball has a certain honor, it has a certain code, and do you feel like that's diminishing a little bit, or is it just recent events make us feel that way?
Here's the thing. Yes, baseball should have a code, and sometimes fighting is part of that code. It's just sort of the way baseball goes, same the way hockey goes.
Mm-hmm.
However, one of my favorite parts about unwritten rules is that they are unwritten, and because they are unwritten, everyone has different opinions on what they are. So one player, and this is, again, I text two guys yesterday, both of them retired, who played in the game for a long time, with completely different reads on how the unwritten rules apply to this event.
Ooh, messy.
But that's what makes it great, and that's what makes sports fun and lets us talk about them and gives us all a different perspective on what happened. So, yes, I do think the code has been lost a little bit over the years, and Major League Baseball has tried to take some of the frontier justice out of the game.
Frontier justice, very good.
But, that's part of the fun of it.
Huh. So if this didn't happen on the field, they would shoot it out in a bar somewhere?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it would necessarily have resorted to guns. But, the guys who fight, and I may have told you this before, they don't always hate each other. There is a story about Jim Thome, who was a Hall of Famer, who got into a fight with a pitcher, a lefty named Riel Cormier. This is years ago. And Tommy charged the mound. I think he threw his helmet at him, and they brawled, and everybody else poured out of the dugout and the bullpen and all that. And at the end of the game, after they'd both been thrown out, Cormier and Tommy drove home together because they were old hunting and fishing buddies and had been for years.
I feel like you should like this. This is like theater, Dave. Well, it reminds me of theater.
It's like politics used to be. You'd fight it out on the floor, and then you'd go to a bar. But, you get hit by – do they at least – throw a slower pitch when they hit the guy? No, that's because you get hit by a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, you can do some damage there, can't you?
And that's one of the things that makes people upset. When you hit someone, they want to be hit below the shoulders. Mm-hmm. If you hit somebody below the shoulders and you're not aiming at their head, there's not a big deal. In fact, I had a pitcher tell me yesterday that, hey, the ball that went high that missed Mike Trout near his head was a worse offense than hitting somebody in the back because it was near the head. And that's the one thing they all do want to try to account for.
I've been hit by a squash ball several times, and it stings, but I would have to think that a baseball would be a lot worse.
Yeah. It would, but A, these guys do wear a fair amount of padding on their elbows. They do have a helmet on their head. I'm not saying it doesn't hurt. I'm just saying they have some padding, probably more than when you're playing squash. Also, they are, and I'm going to have to go out on a limb here, Dave, and I apologize, significantly tougher than you are, or I am, or Colleen is. Well, maybe not Colleen. She has kids, so
I
she gave
hits
birth.
All
so,
the time.
But that sort of goes with the territory, and if you get to the major leagues, you've been hit enough and have enough sort of built-in, I don't know, pain tolerance to deal with
it. So when we see them brawl, what we shouldn't think is, everything is amiss. Mom and dad are fighting. Everything's wrong. They're fighting it out. They're going to take their medicine, and everything's going to be
fine. It's just sort of part of the culture of the game.
And
G will show up here, you know, when he gets back, and G, or you can ask him about it, and he will say, why is it okay in hockey and baseball, but not okay in football and basketball? Yeah. And he has a fair question that he has asked, and he and I have fought about this any number of times, and I understand why he asked the question. It's a fair one. The only answer I can give is that there is some of the culture of baseball and certainly of hockey. And hockey, it's in the rules. Literally, fighting is part of the rules.
They're smaller dudes.
I don't know. I don't buy. I don't. That's not enough of an answer for me.
Right.
I think G's got a decent point that there is obviously a racial difference in the makeup between baseball and hockey versus football and basketball. And he thinks that, and I'm putting words in his mouth, so I apologize, that there's an element of the way we view that changes the way we view these fights. He may have a point. I'm not saying he does not. Hockey, on the other hand, has specifically built into the rules that fighting is allowed, kind of like boxing has built into the rules that fighting is allowed. So
I was wondering about that.
Baseball is an interesting one, though, and I don't, as much as I don't ever, don't tell him I said this, I don't have a good answer for him on baseball.
I think your problem is that since football is a contact sport, you'd have a fight on every single play.
Yeah, maybe, but basketball, there's no reason we couldn't see some level of fighting in basketball, and we used to see more of it. The NBA has decided to clean it up. Baseball has a little bit. You don't see it certainly as often as you used to, but when it happens, I get excited. And for the record, when it happens in basketball, I get excited about that too.
Mike Sox, Seattle Sports 710. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, guys.
Now we turn to the Seattle police shooting death of Charlena Lyles, which is the subject of a police inquest into the killing. And Hannah Scott is here with some details about safety concerns at the proceedings themselves.
Yes, safety concerns, it seems, on both sides, depending on who you talk to. So to get into this, I'm going to go back to last Wednesday, which was the last day of testimony last week. It was a very emotional day. They're all fairly emotional. But on this particular day for Charlie and Elias' family, it was very difficult. They had shown there was a lot of testimony about the first responders who came and chest compressions and various things that they were doing, and also the children who were in the apartment who saw their mom get shot 7 times and them being taken outside to a neighbor. And there was a video shown with her eldest son crying, tears, saying, "They shot my mom." And it was very, very detailed. There were graphic photos of her that were shown in the proceedings as well. So it was tough on the family. Very emotional day. So after that, in the evening, they broke for the week. They weren't going to come back until Monday. Apparently, Officer McNew, who's one of the officers who shot Charlena Lyles, left the room. And the family had been gathered on the steps outside. He walked right through them, which was led to some of the family members saying a couple of words to him.
Yeah.
One calling him a coward, reportedly, and another one that I can't say on the air. He apparently became concerned about that, called his sergeant. 2 days later, the SWAT team showed up to...
At the inquest?
But there was no inquest proceedings going on. So there's nobody there. But 2 days later, they go and they kind of do a surveil of the building. They look at the video of that particular incident from 2 days before, and they're doing kind of a security check. Now, the issue, there's a lot of issues with that. One is that SPD has no jurisdiction over that building. It's the Juvenile Detention and Court Center is what we're talking about, of King County Courts. That belongs to the Sheriff's Department.
This is one on 14th Street.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And they so the administrator of the proceedings yesterday morning, as they got underway, addressed this issue because the Lyles family made they had some concerns about it. The administrator said, look, this is not SPD's area. This should not have happened. This was insensitive for the officer to walk through the family, especially on that day when emotions were high. So I got a call from Katrina Johnson yesterday. This is Charlena Lyles' cousin. And apparently McNew said he was afraid because of the words that were said, which was by Charlena's father, I believe, who called him the coward and whatnot. They were not threatening words. This is what Katrina Johnson says.
The officer is talking about they're in fear. And I'm like, no, us as family members, after hearing that, I'm in complete fear for not only myself, but my family, because he can go and those officers can go and say whatever. And the SWAT team shows up.
And they were, she had several of her family members behind her on the phone when we were speaking, mm-hmm. and they were very riled up.
The intimidation from law enforcement is at an all-time high, and our family is not safe during these inquest proceedings, because I know now that those law enforcement officers that killed Charlena can say whatever, and SPD and SWAT team is going to show up here. And so basically we're sitting ducks under siege, and at no point in time do we know what may or may not happen to our family during the course of this inquest.
Now, she wasn't specific about what they thought might happen, but mostly what they were focused on was the fact that these officers who did shoot and kill the cousin can say, oh, we're worried about something that was said by the family, and they can have the SWAT team respond. It seemed like an overreach. So at any rate, the administrator, Michael Spearman, who's a former Court of Appeals judge, he laid it very strictly out yesterday before the proceeding started. Look, any security that is going to be had in this building is going to be done with the King County Sheriff's Office. I don't want to see any more of this.
So the SWAT team showed out without asking the judge?
Yes, they just came in. SPD sent them out. SPD said in a statement that the officer McNew had some concerns, so this was just a precaution intentionally done on Friday, I believe it was, when they knew that there was no proceedings going on, but still considered concerning.
Sounds intimidating.
Intimidating, right. And that's exactly what the family said. It's intimidation. Yeah. That's as I think you, Katrina, opened that comment with. So. Definitely it's already very tense there, and there's a lot of very emotional testimony going on. And Katrina Johnson said, here's actually one more thing she said. She's very concerned about testimony coming up this week after what's happened.
When they testify on Wednesday and Thursday,
they being the two officers who shot Charlena.
When they testify on Wednesday and Thursday, we should be doubly, basically almost afraid of what they may or may not say. We are completely not safe. We don't have anyone we can call that's going to come here and make sure that we are protected. We're just sitting ducks during this inquest right now.
So, again, SPD said no intent to exercise jurisdiction. It was just a precautionary measure, but it's, again, seen as intimidation. The lawyer, by the way, who's representing these two officers, said it was just, again, precaution. He didn't mean to walk through the family. There's like one kind of hallway to exit. It's kind of tight quarters. He said, look, we just want to get this damn thing over with, was basically what he said to the Seattle Times.
Is there any feeling that among the members of the family that the facts are not coming out or will be suppressed in some way? Is that what they're worried about?
No, certainly there was for the previous 5 years. Yes. No. Yes. And so far, I think Katrina has said that she, she makes no bones about it. She believes that the officers murdered her cousin. And she said nothing she's heard so far has changed her mind about that. Again, this is fact finding. This is not going to lead to any criminal kind of outcome. It's just for the family. This is what this is, to give them their answers. And we've heard, again, seven times she was shot. Several of those shots went through the body. A lot of what the testimony has focused on all of the days, has been where were these children, who I think we had an infant, a 4-year-old, and a 12-year-old. One of the children, a small child, they didn't even know was in the apartment when they opened fire. There was an audio played of one of the officers saying, oh my gosh, they were talking about the one little kid coming up and laying his head on top of the mother's body. And then another one emerging from a bedroom that they didn't even know was there. And it's an apartment, right? So a lot of questions yesterday, again, about the ricochet possibility could that have hit the child, that kind of thing.
The bottom line being they should never have opened fire. Is that that's what the family maintains?
It seems to be a suggestion, but I'm not sure what the actual policy is on that. A lot of discussion about the knife yesterday as well. They say that Charlena lunged at them with a knife. There was a couple of different knives, one of her in her pocket and another one somewhere else in the kitchen. So which one was more of a threat?
So are we still unclear about the sequence of events here, even after all this investigation?
No, I don't think we're unclear. I think what they're trying, they get into this very minutia, if you will, detail for the family member to see what was threatened, what was an actual threat. Was it an overreaction to open fire on someone with a knife that was in her pocket that maybe wasn't going to be close enough to, it's
that's
suggestive.
What it always comes down
it's
to.
It's suggestive, is, though. Yeah. Is, and, yeah. And again, I will reiterate what I told you before. As far as any kind of criminal prosecution coming out of this later, there's malice on the books when this happens.
But has police policy changed? And what would that be? Would you have to check an apartment for the presence of children? Would you have to know exactly what kind of knife it is?
I think that the checking for children is a case-by-case basis, if I'm not mistaken, because it depends on what they're coming at you with. Probably, maybe for a knife if you can. I think we still see this, though. We have the guy it was less than a year ago, down on Alaskan Way, who was having a mental health crisis, I believe was suicidal, had a kitchen knife of some sort walking around down there on Alaskan Way with no people around. Cops came in and that was not de-escalated either. And he ended up being shot and killed. So I think there's stuff in the works because of our new laws that have passed. There's training that comes with that, but not all of the officers in the state have done that training. And SPD has some of its own training under the consent decree. So I don't know that all of that has changed. Could this happen again? Maybe. That's the best I got.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. 7-year-old boy named Bo Dowling has cancer, and his dream came true when he ran the bases in a home run for life prior to the Chicago White Sox game against the Baltimore Orioles on Saturday. Players from both teams lined the bases, gave him encouraging high fives.
Ladies and gentlemen, please rise and join the Chicago White Sox and Baltimore Orioles in cheering on Bo as he takes his home run for life.
The 7-year-old who beat high risk and often fatal neuroblastoma as a toddler was recently diagnosed with thyroid cancer for the second time. He underwent surgery earlier this month, according to MLB.com. Bo also got to throw out the first pitch to Southpaw, the official mascot for the White Sox. Now, believe it or not, his family is not just helping Bo survive cancer again. 2 weeks after his most recent diagnosis, Bo's older sister, who's 17, discovered she has ovarian cancer. So now the family has two kids to take care of. Well, a group focused on supporting families with children battling cancer had yet another surprise for the family at the ballgame.
Founder Dan Wisher and Dave Wisher are here to present the Dowling family with a $10,000 check in hopes of bringing joy and financial relief during their battle with cancer. To the Dowlings.
There you have it, $10,000 to help with their financial hardships.
Wow. That is a lot on one family.
I know. I had to look at it twice because I couldn't quite believe that, his sister too. So hopefully they all do well in this latest battle. Come on, Ursula, you got to sing it.
Oh, this is my favorite.
I didn't know this was your walk-on music.
Yes. 749, welcome to the Cairo Dance Party of your new feature, Seattle's Morning News.
I know. Good who knows morning. Those hips could shake that way, Dave? Look at you go.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Did you stretch
about
this morning?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about. From the Gene Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock here on Cairo News Radio, here's Ursula Roitin. I was wondering when someone would suggest this, and it was Pramila Jayapal, who discussed the idea yesterday of a national women's strike. So, you going to do it?
I love the sentiment, and I understand the anger and the frustration. But my question is, if women all go on strike, to what end? What are we achieving by going on strike? And what could potentially be the harm at a time when our economy is in a bit of a tailspin? So my initial reaction was, I get the anger, I get the sadness, I get the frustration, but I would rather use that energy for something other than let's all go on strike.
Hmm.
And what does a strike look like? I mean, and where do men play a role in this?
Well, like, we'd have to stay home because nothing would be working. So.
What do you think, Colleen?
I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure if striking from work is the best idea since it really has nothing to do with abortion, right? I think, when was the last, did women do a sex strike at one point? Wasn't that used?
That was in Greek.
That was in Greek.
It's called marriage. Yeah.
Oh, no. Sully now.
Sully!
It's with the sexist jokes. Good for you.
Watch it, Sully.
No, I mean, it's not true.
No, Sully, you've been married a long time.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought it was interesting what you said about, you know, doing it at this time would be bad for the economy. And I'm going, wow, like America just failed women and you're still going, but we need to help the economy. Like that's an interesting.
Well, I don't want to characterize it like that. I mean, I get it. But what I'm saying is that the most effective way? America failed women. Now, let's get real. Not every woman believes the way you and I do. I think you and I are on the same page, but not every woman feels that way.
If you believe abortion is simply killing babies, right? I think that there are a lot of women who are pro-life who don't like to acknowledge that abortion is used for miscarriages, abortion is used for ectopic pregnancies. 100%. So when they find themselves in that position, what I'm saying is, yeah, you'll find that America has failed you too when you need those services.
Exactly.
You can be pro-life and still be failed by the country.
Exactly. Yes, you can. But again, I don't like to speak for all women. Mm-hmm. But for me, I just don't think it is a realistic thing. I understand the feelings behind it.
Yeah.
But in a practical sense, what would that look like?
Yeah. Protest is never practical.
Yeah. And then how long does it go? So, I mean, and you know,
I'd like
we
a
march
week off? I'm actually taking a week off next week, so I'm good. But Dave, you're just standing back You're just waiting for the flames to start.
So if you say you want to take a week off, though, I mean, then what? What is it going
to
achieve?
What would be similar? What would make me feel? Because I was talking with a few women I know, and they're pissed off.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to think of what the equivalent Supreme Court ruling would be affecting men. I mean, compulsory snipping, you know, even that's not the same.
There's nothing that goes on with you guys that
exactly
can be controlled by the government or
right
wants to be controlled.
It's basically compelled birth. So I don't know, you know.
I suppose if the government said, like, this is a ridiculous situation, but you hear how many ED commercials we have on this. So if you lose your ability to do that and you seek services to do it and the government going, no, if you can't have one anymore, then that's just the way it is.
I suppose,
the only,
but even that.
It's superficial, right? And it's all about pleasure, whereas abortion is about life and birth and women's bodies.
All I can think of, I mean, the reason behind a strike would be as a show of power. But not all women are on board with the.
That's my point.
You know, are for abortion rights. So I don't know what you do.
So and again, I would rather use that energy. What are the things that might actually work? Well, how about putting efforts into getting people into Congress that would be also in favor of codifying on a federal level. Mm-hmm. Abortion rights,
organizing,
for example,
to get services to people. Yeah,
exactly. Or putting more money into organizations that support reproductive health services.
Oh, yeah.
How about this? Suppose the Supreme Court ruled that all men were compelled to grow a beard.
There you go.
How about that all men were compelled to continue to support the child?
That's already the law. That's already the law.
Yeah. How often, you know.
It's got to be enforced now.
Exactly.
States, right? I mean,
that's what I mean. Exactly. Yeah.
And I understand you can do conclusive DNA tests during pregnancy of who the father is.
It's
invasive. It's a simple blood test.
It's invasive.
No, they don't have to take the child's
amniotic
blood anymore.
Fluid? They don't have to.
No, they can take just a mother's blood because the fetal cells are flowing around in it. So you can establish paternity from,
genius,
I would assume, right after conception.
But
the checks will start coming.
But just to be clear, for you know, for both of you, I believe you when you say it. Yeah, it shouldn't be convenient. And that's why I love seeing the protests. But I want to just look at what is it that we could do that would actually affect change.
Tell your stories.
Yeah. And that's I think that's the most effective thing, too.
Yeah.
Ursula Routine, 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. And on Tuesdays, we go live to Washington, D.C., and New York Times investigative reporter David Farenthold. Boy, it has been a busy week since you and I last talked, David. Let's just jump into the story that's breaking today, and that is this snap hearing of the January 6th committee. The Congress is on break, so they weren't going to have one today. But they called it anyway because they have apparently a top aide to Mark Meadows, who is the White House chief of staff. So just tell us why this person's so important.
Well, this woman's name is Cassidy Hutchinson, and she was an assistant to Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff on January 6th and at the end of Trump's term. We don't really know what she's going to say, but the implication seems to be that she saw something, heard something that we haven't heard before from the last, the January 6th and the last days of Trump's presidency. I think the Democrats have been hoping that there would be, quote unquote, another John Dean. That was the figure from Watergate who became sort of like the narrator and the witness who brought it all together in Watergate. And I think they're hoping that she can tell us something about what happened inside the White House, what Trump was saying, what Trump was doing that we didn't know before. And I would be interested particularly to see if she says, here's Trump directing what happened on January 6th. Here's some Trump planning for there to be a storming of the Capitol or planning for, Mike Pence to be injured. So far, what we've heard is that Trump sort of lit the fuse, but then stood back and didn't arrange things or control things on that day.
Now, this is important because Mark Meadows himself does not want to testify, correct?
That's right. Meadows turned over a lot of his texts and other things, which have been really key evidence for the committee, but he himself has not testified. And the committee referred him to the Justice Department for contempt of Congress because of that.
Right. Okay. Your paper, The New York Times, is reporting on another Trump-related investigation. This time, this is an investigation into the company that's funding his social media platform, which is Truth Social, I think.
That's right. Truth Social, which is up and running. I'm not on it, but I'm told it's up and running. Trump had this plan to take it public in the stock market through something called a SPAC, a Special Purpose Acquisition Company. Basically, it was a company that would agree to basically merge – a company that is listed as a shell company that would merge with Trump's company and bring Trump's company into the stock market. That company is called Digital World Acquisition Company. There's been a lot of questions raised about that transaction by the Times particularly because one of the rules about SPACs is that you can't – when you start your SPAC, you can't have in mind who you're going to merge with. That breaks some SEC rules. You have to start the SPAC with no idea and then go out and find your merger target later.
How do you prove that?
Well, it seems like a hard thing to prove, but the Times reported that there was some evidence, some discussions that, there's some indications that actually the guy who started the SPAC might have known, hey, I'm going to target Trump. I'm going to merge with Trump even before he started the SPAC. If you could prove that, that could be a violation of securities law. The revelation yesterday was that a New York state grand jury has been asking questions about the SPAC. New York obviously is the home of the Trump Organization and the home of Wall Street. And so, if you remember back to the Elliott Spitzer days, the New York Attorney General has actually some power over Wall Street. So that could be what we're seeing here.
I didn't think Trump started this to make money. I thought it was because he was having trouble getting his message out.
Well, I think the hope was that he could do both. And you remember back in the fall, the price of this SPAC, long before there was a Truth Social, before it, his company was doing anything, the price went through the roof. I mean, it went up from $10, I think, up to $90, maybe even more than that. And it's been slowly declining. It's now back in the 20s. Mm. So I don't know if Trump has made any money off of it yet, but somebody did, at least back in the early days.
Okay. Regardless of his finances, what is his how powerful is he now post this abortion decision? Because a lot of people will tell you, hey, yeah, we don't like Trump as a person, but he's going to change the Supreme Court. And actually, you go back to the debate with Hillary. He predicted this. He predicted the number of justices he'd pick, and he predicted that Roe v. Wade would go down. So does this empower him even more?
It's an interesting question. Obviously, there's been people like Mark Thiessen, a columnist for The Washington Post, who wrote yesterday, the day before, like, you know, I didn't like Trump. I hope he doesn't run again. You know, I didn't like what he did on January 6th. But thank God for Donald Trump, because he did this thing that no conservatives have ever done. He appointed three judges, which was sort of luck, but also he appointed people who stayed conservative, didn't turn liberal like past Republican nominees had. So that has caused people to praise Trump. On the other hand, the idea that Trump could bring down Roe versus Wade was a reason for a lot of sort of Christian conservatives, other Republicans who didn't like the Trump that much, to sort of get in line behind him. Now it's happened. Now you've got the thing. So maybe, you know, Trump's the sort of sales pitch Trump made in 2016, which is like, you don't like me, but I can win and get you what you want. That may be a little less powerful. Now they've got what they want.
Yeah. There was a Politico headline which said, quote, Trump fatigue sets in. Of course, we've heard him, you know, pronounced as done, stick a fork in him many times, and he keeps coming back. But now this time, I'm seeing that Mike Pence obviously positioning for a run. Ron DeSantis also raising a lot of money, apparently, Governor of Florida, and and not seeking Trump's endorsement. How significant is that?
I think it is interesting. We've seen, I mean, Trump was a great politician because he was surprising. Every day you had to ask, you know, what did Trump do? Even if you didn't like him, what did Trump do? What did Trump say? And when was the last time we said that, right? That he's lost that ability to surprise. He's hanging out at Mar-a-Lago around the pool. And, you know, the person who is making the headlines, who is angering the liberals, who is getting that kind of, you know, buzz every day is DeSantis. DeSantis has done a really good job of doing things that push liberals' buttons, raise some anger, and get him some airtime. I mean, he's tapping into the same sort of grievances that Trump did, where, you know, the woke world sneers at, you know, people like us, or, you know, the real Americans are being sneered at by the liberals. But DeSantis is doing that in a way that's surprising and different and gets media attention in a way that Trump isn't now. So I'm not surprised. I mean, nothing lasts forever. Trump had a good run, but I think DeSantis is tapping into the same feelings that Trump did in a new way, and he's got a little bit of novelty behind him that's helping him.
Yeah. There's some indication of concern among Democrats. I'll play this clip of Governor Inslee. He was concerned about Mike Pence.
We have supported access to reproductive care, and we have supported abortion rights of women. But Mike Pence and the Republican Party have a plan to take away this right from Washington women, and we intend to stop them.
I mean, he called out Mike Pence, and I'm guessing it's because Mike Pence was looking good because of his role in January 6th. So he's worried about a challenge from him. Patty Murray in this state is spending $1 million against her basically unknown Republican opponent. And they're, I don't know, Democrats, you would think, would be on the march, but they seem afraid. What's your assessment?
I think you're right. There is a malaise and a fear there that is surprising. I mean, I think they, in many cases, Democrats kind of wrote off the 2022 election back in 2021. And obviously, Biden is an older president. He's not. He's got a lot going on. He's not providing sort of the powerful leadership he did. The Bernie wing of the party is a little bit hurt by the idea that there's so much inflation. You know, their solution to everything was to spend a lot of government money, and that seems like less popular now. There's not really a leader, and there's not really somebody with energy behind them in the Democratic Party, and there's not an idea other than sort of defend the Republic against Donald Trump that animates them all. So I really just see this malaise that, you know, to me it's really surprising, A, because there are things that are angering their base, like the Roe versus Wade decision, but also because if you look at polling, their candidates are actually doing better than you would expect in a lot of Senate races and other places. The ship is not lost, but I do see a sense that they're ready to give up, or they don't have anything they're ready to fight for, which could be pretty damaging, even in blue states. I mean, Oregon, the Democratic governor could be in trouble.
By the way, any update on the secession of Texas, your home state?
I'm still against it. I don't think it's moved any closer to happening, but I remain dead set opposed to it. I think we're better off with Texas, and Texas is better off with us.
David Farenthold from The New York Times. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM, or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.